Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is publisher Greg Watts. But first of all, there's some news from last week. Spotify may buy SoundCloud. Now, on the surface, you might think, why would they do that? That's not such a good business move. But there are some underlying reasons why this could work. The first being that SoundCloud is more like YouTube than it is like any of the other streaming services. And one of the beauties of that is it brings a lot of user-generated content, and it brings a lot of users that are creators, content creators. And of course, Spotify wants to get more content creators online, so this would be a way to do it. Now, what's interesting as well is SoundCloud has 175 million active users. 175 million. Spotify, which is the streaming leader in terms of paid subscriptions, only has 40 million. So this would be kind of a cheap way in order to get a lot of subs really, really fast. And also, of course, the major labels are really against Spotify's free tier, its ad-supported tier, and they want Spotify to eliminate it. But this may be a way of appeasing the major labels somewhat and saying, okay, let's just go with this ad-supported tier for the SoundCloud level only. So that's another thing that they're kind of looking at. But I think the big thing is, how do we get more artists, more content creators on Spotify? And by buying SoundCloud, that might be a way that they'll actually do it. So we'll see what happens. Myself, I don't think it's going to happen. It just doesn't seem like a good synergy to me, but I can see the underlying reasons why they might consider it. If you have any questions or comments, please send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget to check out my 101 Mixing Tricks program and my other online video courses at bobbyosinskicourses.com. You can also check out my music industry and music production blogs. Just go to bobbyosinski.com to find links, and you can also find excerpts from my books there as well. A couple of conferences in this last week that were very cool. One was Game Sound Con. All about game sound, all about game audio, and it really drew a small but very fervent crowd. There were more people there than I thought. I don't know, maybe 1,000. And surprisingly enough, there was a good amount of women there. So that's always good to see, women in the audio business. There's not enough of them, but it looks like, thanks to game sound, game audio, that might be changing. Now, this was held at the Biltmore Hotel, one of the older and most beautiful hotels in Los Angeles. And it covered things like basic audio for gaming. And this was for people that are audio engineers but don't necessarily know a lot about gaming. There were introductory classes for that, which were very cool. It covered VR workflow for virtual reality, and there's a lot about virtual reality there. Composing for games, all about sound design for games. Bit budgeting for games, which is a lot more extensive than I ever would have thought, and something that you really have to be good at in order to make audio for games really work. Game Sound Con was put on by Brian Schmidt, who was actually on the podcast a few weeks ago, and he did a great job. Brian is one of the legends of that industry. And it also included case studies and software tools and a number of things that I didn't have enough time to cover. So if a conference like this ever comes near you, you should go and check it out, especially if you want to open up your avenues to more and different work, because this looks like it's a part of the business that's really exploding. The AES convention was also in Los Angeles last week at the convention center. Pretty good attendance on this, and the attendees had a pretty good attitude. I didn't hear any grief and woe, and I didn't hear anybody talking about smaller budgets or losing gigs or anything. For the most part, it was very positive. That's always nice. There were companies that were selling big consoles, and there are people that were actually buying them, and that's unusual. One of the things I did notice, though, is there are fewer vendors than you would expect. So in other words, it wasn't every audio company that you kind of expect at AES shows, and we've seen at AES shows in the past. In fact, there were fewer hardware companies, and there were a lot fewer software companies, and probably because it's too expensive for them to go. Once again, you'll see those companies at NAMM, and you won't see them at AES. which is kind of unusual because at AES you have a very focused crowd. They're only audio people. That's really what they care about. So you'd think that they want to be there, but I guess the cost of doing both is way too much. So not as many software companies as you might expect. I saw a lot of good demos. Oceanway monitors, of course. I've loved Alan Side's monitors since he started to build them for A&M way, way, way back when in the 70s. I guess the 80s when I first heard them the first time. And his monitors are always impressive. JBL, with their new L7 series, is pretty impressive as well. Especially they have a very small, tiny 5-inch woofer monitor, two-way monitor. That's just amazing how good and how big that sounds. So that was impressive. One of the most interesting exhibits was something called RackFX. And what that was is a software platform that allowed you to upload your file, your audio file. And let's say you wanted to put it through a Fairchild limiter, but you wanted a real one. Well, what they do is they find an owner of a Fairchild, for instance, or it could be a real LA-2A or just pick your hardware piece. And what they would do is they would then download it, process it through that piece of hardware, and then upload it and give it back to you. And they even went another step. They actually had robot controls that you could put on these devices where if you wanted, you can remotely dial in the sound that you wanted. So this is called RackFX. I don't know if it's going to make it or not, but it's really interesting. So check it out, RackFX.com. Along with the AES show, there was a sub-conference, and it was called Audio for Virtual Reality, or AVR. Once again, there was a lot of excitement around this and a lot of people. What we saw were new tools just for AVR, workstation tools, microphones, capture tools, lots of software, more and more attention to immersive audio. Immersive audio is going to be something you're going to hear more and more about in the future. One of the interesting things is there's no killer app yet. In other words, there hasn't been a video, a project, a song, a music video, whatever, that has blown people's minds so much that that has become the avenue that everybody follows. So it's still the Wild Wild West. Everyone is figuring out how to do this, and it reminds me of the old days of surround sound in 2000, 2001, when we were just making it up and going by the seat of our pants. It's the same thing again. And because of that, it's very exciting. My guest today is Greg Watts, who heads DWB Music out of the UK. DWB has had a lot of success in the Asian market, and Greg gives some advice for writing for that market, as well as a look at how the company's writing camps work. I spoke with Greg via Skype from a studio in the UK. So I take it you started as a songwriter before you became a publisher, right?
I did, yes. So, yes, first of all, songwriting. I moved into publishing really when we needed someone to sell the songs. So it was a natural process.
Well, that's usually the problem, isn't it? It's really easy to create stuff. It's hard to sell it. I know I've always had that problem myself.
Yeah. I guess I was, I did kind of have a sales history. I used to work in a bank and they always were wanting me to sell stuff. I think I just have that instinct, I guess. And I tended to be the top liner and the melody writer or the lyricist. So if when I was working with one of my partners, Paul or Pete, they were the more hands-on producers, I had the more time to go and do the selling, I guess, while they were left in the studio to do the nitty-gritty production work. So, yes, I'm always that, looking for where we can put the song. Because I think that's the creative full circle of a song is, you know, we're seeing it performed. So I hate to sort of see them sat on a shelf not doing anything. So
right.
I think that drives it. When you sell the song, it drives you right. You know, it keeps the circle going in a sense.
Well, describe what your catalogue is.
We've been going as a company for about 10 years. So I would say we were very pop melody driven. So in the style of, in the old school style of, you know, I was brought up in the 80s, so I listened to all the classic music from the 80s, you know, Duran Duran and Wham and Elton John and just great, great pop songs. And I think our catalogue obviously doesn't sound like the 80s, as in the production and things like that, but I think we're based on melody. So, you know, we want to keep that. And I believe that songs that will that do last are very, very melody orientated. Yeah. That's what always stays with us.
Well, yeah, and for a publisher, you really need that because you need something with longevity, and which is one of the problems with EDM, or, you know, things that are so EDM based that kind of forget the top line.
Yes, no, and I think what's happening at the moment is we're finding there's a lot of EDM or a lot of dance or DJ producers who are suddenly looking for melody top lines. So we're tending to, we're moving into a little bit of a stage where sometimes we can just write a really good song and do it acoustically. As long as the recording's good, you can hand it over to a DJ and go, well, there you go. Because it's, and it still goes back to that old school writing though of, you know, there's actually great songs and a great voice, but now we need some of the productions that the DJs are doing to get them released. It's just coming full circle, I think. I think melody never really dies off. Every now, it goes out for a couple of years and it goes more to production maybe, and then I think it comes back because the record labels realise that what makes the money is a real song. So
that's really smart to do that.
Have I just told everyone what to do? Yeah. No, that's just you notice patterns, don't you?
Suddenly,
I've noticed that we're doing quite a lot of work in Holland all of a sudden, and Holland is a very DJ-led country. So and sort of noticing them saying, no, we want real songs. We don't want a couple of hooks. We want a real song, and they'll break it down and almost put it in a song format with their interesting dance moves, in a sense. So.
One of the things I noticed, I was looking at your website, and it seems that you have a global perspective rather than just being focused on the UK.
Yes, right from the very beginning. I think when we used to go to the UK and have meetings, we'd have, we love your songs, but what have you done before? And we would be like, well, not very much, you know. And then, so first of all, I think we went off to a place. The first thing we really did was go to Mid-Em in France and kind of trying to connect there, and I think we mainly connected with some Belgian companies there, and then we suddenly really had some big hits in Belgium. And that was our way of building up what have we done before. And then we found Asia and did lots and lots in Asia. We still go to the UK now, and they're like, these are really good. What have you done? And now it's more like, you're the guys who are very successful in Asia. So, but we're... Our perspective is worldwide. I mean, I'm from the UK. I was brought up on a UK music business, but I've travelled a lot, and there's some really exciting markets out there, which for me are even more exciting than the UK market. UK market can be quite insular and quite not outward looking. We're actually, interestingly, the government had a meeting with at Downing Street recently, where they were quite interested in what we're doing because we're one of the most global outlooking UK publishers, because most of our success is coming outside. So big world out there, I think.
You have a lot of success in Asia. Do you have to write differently for that market?
I think we were, definitely, when we first started. Well, initially, the first success we had in Asia with an Irish boy band, so no, I'd say no for that. And then we got a cut with a band called Toshinki, and that was a song that we'd written for an English boy band. So no, we hadn't written anything different. Then when we started to sort of know that we wanted to aim there, I guess we connected with more Japanese people or Koreans, and they told us, do write differently. I think we did for a bit, and then we did get more cuts, and then slowly that kind of took a bit of creativity out of what we did, I think, as well. So actually the last two or three years we've gone back to writing great songs, because some of the ones that have got cuts or released goes back to they were just great songs that we'd written. And I think one in particular, I remember when it was released with when we were told that it was going to get released by a big Korean act, I actually couldn't remember pitching that song and thinking, so I looked back through my emails and it was the last one that I pitched. I knew that I pitched it everywhere, that song, because I really believed in it, and it didn't feel like a Korean song, but it kind of taught me, you know, actually if it's a good song, it will go any, you know, it, you can find anywhere. And actually that band then had, you know, it sold about a million copies in Korea, and then they changed the, what they do towards what that song did. So I think, again, goes back to any, a really great song speaks for itself and can end up anywhere. So I think we now go back to writing great songs and hoping, yes, we are connected in Asia, so they may go in Asia, but they could also go elsewhere. There's a few things we do differently, just like probably more syllables in the writing and more rhythmic, and simply because language is, in England, hello, compare that to konnichiwa in Japan, you know, it's two syllables to four syllables. So again, there's a little bit of mathematics in it. Most of the syllables, you need a few more.
Interesting.
But other than that, we've gone back to, let's just write great songs. And I think that has actually released our creativity again, and actually we've resulted in getting better results again. So,
is there a difference between Japan and Korea?
Yes, definitely. Japan's kind of got the very J-pop, the very Japanese market, which again I think for us as UK guys, and I'm sure we can really try. We can try. That was one of the things we tried to work for that, and it didn't really work. Swedish guys seem to be able to get up in the morning and write a song, and it sounds like J-pop. And yeah. I think that goes back to some sort of cultural route where there's something similar in Japanese J-pop and schlager, Swedish schlager, because the one guy that could do that in our team, who's a UK guy, was actually a guy called Ian Curnow, who he was part of the PWL Stocktaking and Waterman team when he was younger. And obviously that was based on ABBA.
Yeah.
And that goes back to Swedish schlager. So there was a, you know, there is a link there. What we're better at is probably the Korean side. Our cuts were coming, even if they were in Japan, they were with the Korean acts. So the first one, which was Toshinki, was a Korean act releasing their first record in Japan. I think that's, Korea is more Western looking, and Korea tends to, so there, for instance, a couple of years ago, when Mark Ronson, when we had the Uptown Funk,
yeah,
about 6 months later, Korea looks for Uptown Funk, and then about 6 months, 9 months after that, Japan follows. So Korea is much more Western looking, and also they're starting to come out. The Koreans are, you know, I believe from what I'm told, the Japanese are very happy with their Japanese market. It's big, it, you know, does its own thing, and they're happy just to carry on in Japan. Korea, the government really wants Korea and Korean music to come out, Korean culture to come out, so they're investing heavily in it coming out of Korea. So we recently had a song cut by a big act in Korea, which I believe it was got top 10 in 13 different countries in the world. Which, so in a sense, sometimes Korean music is becoming more powerful than maybe a UK act, which stayed in the UK. So,
how about the US? So, do you deal much with the US, and how is that market different as compared to what you're dealing with?
We're not as successful in the US, and I think one of the main reasons is I think you have to be there. Most of the places that we are successful, I've gone and we've spent time there, and I think US in particular, even you need to be there even more time. Someone I know who's been successful there kind of put in, really was there once every 2 months, you know, and was back once, so, and therefore he could build up the relationships. We've kind of done that. We've been a couple of times, and we have much more interest from the US than we do in the UK, I believe. And I think maybe that's the UK writers or English writers are more interesting to people outside England, and you know, in the English labels like the Swedish. And I don't know. Maybe it's all a bit mixed up. But so we've had we had one thing last year, which was a single for a dance act called Project 46. But I'm busy, really, really busy with Europe and Asia, and I'd love to do America as well. But what we really need is partners in America, yeah, to pull that along, because a lot often it is, you find the right part. We found the right partner in Japan. We then found the right one in Korea. We've now working in, you know, so it is about relationships. I think we need those in America. And really, me or one of the others needs to go to America long term and put some proper effort into that as well. But we need some of the other work to slow down as well, because or for it to grow enough to take some more staff on, I think. So.
Well, it's good to be busy, that's for sure. What's it like getting paid from all of those different countries? Do you have a hard time getting paid, and or just tracking the number of plays, number of views, number of sales? Do you have a hard time with Asia, that?
Asia, we found the best place. It seems there's real honesty and loyalty in these countries where they, when people have bought out productions, we often, in UK, you'll often ask for 50% of the money up front before you send the files, because, you know, you're worried that you might not get paid. In Asia, right at the beginning, we were told, in Japan in particular, can you send the files, you know, we'll pay you in 3 months. And we kind of were like, oh, this is a bit different. And the Japanese partner was like, trust me that, you know, you will get paid. And we probably sold 50, 60 productions like that and have always been paid. So you learn that the Japanese or Asian word is kind of like, that's their honor, I guess. So it's in a way, it's nice being, you know, you're going to get paid since you've got over that initial, oh, are we definitely going to get paid? And sure. You do. Well, with royalties. Royalties is good. You know, it's a good tracking system. It does come in quick, and often quicker than Europe. So,
I would think that because Asia is so based in sales still of physical product rather than online, that obviously that's more lucrative.
Yes. Yeah. So we find that mechanical royalties, Asia or Japan and Korea, is very driven by mechanical royalties. So the CD sales, the DVD sales. Basically, a lot of it's all done around the concerts. So they're still driving their market through the fans go to the concert, the DVD. So you have an album, which is based around the concert. The DVD is then released of a live concert. So they've kept their sales very high by almost having 3 or 4 releases around an album. Whereas in Europe and the UK, so you do still sell albums, but not to that quantity. And really the income is if you get a single and if you get radio play and if you get TV play. So there's an interesting balance of Asia seems to be driven by better at mechanical sales, and Europe and the UK is better at performance. So really you want a bit of both, because then you get a bit of, you know, you're getting a nice balance of income coming from both sides. So
I know the publishers that I talk to here, they're somewhat befuddled by streaming royalties, only because they're not always sure what they're getting is what they deserve, so to speak. Do you find that?
Yeah, I think it's a problem in we are sort of UK mechanical statements of over the last couple of years, they've kind of almost disappeared totally, you know, so, or you do get the statements, the amount is very small, but you've got hundreds of these tiny lines of 0.0001, you know, and it's like, is it worth actually someone spending time adding that, you know, doing publishing statements, because it just doesn't add up, you know. So we've gone from we accounted everything by line to you account everything, but you start doing the subtotal, because really it's not worth it for anyone to do 0.0002. And that's where, you know, for me, I was doing some of the admin at one point, it slowed us down on the sales side and things like that, so we had to think very quickly of, no, let's get an admin person to do that. So it released me back into the sales avenue. So I don't know what the answer is, though, with streaming, because I think Sweden will, for Spotify, will sort of say it's starting to work, because as people start to subscribe, that it's bringing levels back up. Not, I don't think they'll ever be like they were in the 80s or 90s, but it's bringing it back up to higher than what has been over the past few years. But I don't... it's one of those things you see on Facebook or on the internet, a lot of, you know, songwriters need to stand up and claim their rights and things like that. And I think we do in some senses, but we somehow we need to do that as a collective, because you can't do it as one. You know, I think often the labels have sold a lot of the rights of the songwriters without actually, it seems, you know, being consulted. So we've definitely lost something along the way, I think. So
yeah, I think some of the problem there too is, instead of looking at it from a global perspective, it's more country by country. Because I know here that instead of being unified, the industry being unified, it's very stratified, where you have the songwriters over here, you have the publishers over here, and you have the record labels over here, and they all have their own associations and their own agenda. And
yeah,
that it sort of clashes, so you never really get the overall. Here, what we need is copyright reform more than anything, and that's not going anywhere right now, I think, mostly because of that problem.
It's a complicated business, I think, as in, you know, just collecting royalties. If you have you missed one tick almost in the chain, you find that someone hasn't got paid, you know, a year or two later. So to add all that up into a label, what they, you know, a label does their own thing, a publisher does their own thing. I think it is a complicated business. We maybe there's a, you know, we do need something more globally. I know that the UK system for collecting royalties isn't always tied up with another, you know, something else in Europe, and that can be a real mess.
Yeah.
I know that I was at a conference in Russia recently, and they were talking about blockchain, maybe something that sorts that out. I don't know. We'll see. But
well, I have to say, every week I get a press release, I get a phone call, I get something that I see with someone with a new blockchain for music idea. Or a new company that's starting up with that idea. And so far, there's been no traction whatsoever.
No. So, but there's always new ideas, and we need one really that connects everything together. There's something called Audley, which I know we had on a camp recently, where everyone registers their stuff and it tries to link everything together. But again, computer systems only have so much, you know, we need, if you do another set of information on one place, and then for me, I'm looking at that idea is really good, but can we connect it to the PRS, and can we connect it to ASCAP, and all the, because if you can put it in one place and press a button where everything connects, I think that's one of the biggest problems solved. But
yeah,
I don't know, I'm not a computer, you know, I'm not technical, unfortunately, so I'm not the person to do it. But
yeah, right.
But you know, I'm aware that when you get royalties in, you think, I bet you we're missing lots from different countries where something's been played on a worldwide TV show and it's just not being connected, you know, so.
Yeah, right.
We certainly found, in Eastern Europe, some really interesting things. We've done some Eurovision stuff where a lot of the Eastern Europeans don't know there's royalties. Because they have a whole system which is totally, you know, they have upfront money.
Yeah.
So that was interesting to, you know, uncover. Okay, they don't know there's royalties. We can collect, you know. So that's, you know, so.
Wow.
But wow. It's a whole different mind set, because the UK system has been hundreds of years old. You know, there's France, which is hundreds of years old, whereas I guess Eastern Europe hasn't had that set up.
Yeah.
So they're only bringing out, the same as China now. China is now trying to set things up. Someone said to me the other day, they've got a hit single in India. And I asked one of the publishers in India, can we, you know, is you interested in collecting this? And he kind of said, oh, the state of the Indian PRS at the moment, or Performing Rights Society at the moment, is not worth it. So it's kind of like, really? And this is a hit? Oh, so there's a problem.
Yeah.
But nice for that songwriter if they could actually sort that out, because that's how we do make a living.
Yeah, no kidding. I noticed on your website, there was an entry about songwriting camps.
Yes.
Is that something you specialize in then? Is this just for your own writers, or is it something that goes outside?
No. I would say we are starting to be specialists in this area. I don't think it was like anything we've done, really. I don't think we said, let's do songwriting camps and become good at it. It was we have three studios here, and we do a small gathering, and then suddenly you think, oh, this is a camp. And then you went on a few other places, and then we did some big Japanese ones at our other studios where it was eight to ten rooms, and you suddenly find that, say, we were there for 4 days and 30 odd songs get written. It was a very good way of managing the right writers for a real focus, and then at the end of it you have that many songs. Obviously not all of them get released, but in general, because everyone's been focused towards the same thing, you come out with some real quality. And I think as we've done that for Japan, and then we've started to do it for Eurovision, and then so the writers are really enjoying the fact that they can be focused on something. And I think we are becoming known for being specialists at that, and then people will come to us and say, can you do a camp for this? So we're starting to move into that, in a sense, and I'm starting to be offered to go and A&R someone else's camp. And I just think I'm a songwriter, and I didn't do much songwriting for a while, but the creative organising of other songwriters is also a real creative buzz for me, because at the end of it you come out and think, well, for instance, we won Eurovision's Melody Grand Prix last year. Sorry, we won Norway's Melody Grand Prix last year, which is basically their qualification for Eurovision. So we got to represent Norway at Eurovision, and that came from a camp that we'd planned about Eurovision. So it felt like it all came together, and that was very an exciting journey. One for me and the three different writers who, one were on the camp and then went off to Norway to be in the Melody Grand Prix and won that big television competition there, then went to Sweden together to be in Eurovision. It's a big, really great journey they followed together, sort of thing. So for me, there's a real creative buzz there as well.
Well, tell me more about managing the camp. How do you go about doing that? You said you're focusing the songwriters. What does that mean exactly?
Well, so beforehand we plan who we're going to have. So if we pick a subject, then we want the best writers for that particular subject. So we plan that quite for a good 2 or 3 months beforehand, making sure we've got the right people. And then before the camp starts, certainly for the first day, I will organise the teams. So we'll have, say we have 8 rooms, we'll have 3 writers in each room, usually a producer, and then 2 top liners, one of which can sing. And sometimes it'll be an artist will be in the room, which does help as well, because you can be writing for the artist. And then I'll plan the first day. And then in the morning of the first day, I'll kind of give a welcome, and then hopefully we usually do a little video, kind of inspiring video, just 5-10 minutes, and then give a little briefing, and then really send people off into their teams, which I'll announce by one. And then during the day, I'll go around probably 2 or 3 times. You know, after a couple of hours, you go around, check they're all okay. Usually they haven't got anything that full to listen to, or they don't want you to listen to at that point. And then you go around again a couple of hours later, and then they start to say, yes, can we play this to you? So you start to hear it. And you generally, if you've planned the camp well, you've got something good anyway, because you know the writers are strong. Sometimes you'll be like, okay, you're going off in the wrong direction, you might need to bring them back. Other times it's just, great, go with what you've got, let's keep going. You come back again in a couple of hours, and hopefully they're starting to record vocals at that point. I used to announce team, you know, here's the teams for the 4 days, but I learned that actually you're better off doing the first day and then seeing what the personalities you've got are as well, because when you've got a camp, you tend to have half of the writers you know exactly, and the other half you've brought in as specialists. And they give you the CV and you hear the songs and you think this is what they can do. And then most of the time that's right. But also then you have people's personalities and egos and things like that. So at the end of the first day, you can really go, okay, that person will not work with that person tomorrow, because I know they'll clash, I'll know that this session with this person and that person is better to move around, because actually there's psychology in it. And so I think being liquid or fluid for the next day is actually a really strong strength as well. And I know a lot of camps don't do that, but because the writer's always like, well, who am I with? They want to know. And I'm always like, well, no, just trust, you know, because I think actually that can be the make or break of each day's session, is not actually having it set out, but not announcing it until just in case we made a couple of adjustments. I know each camp I've done recently, we've definitely done that. And the sessions have been better because of that. So,
are they all 4 days?
No, 4 days we tend to do three or four days. Mm. I think days is enough. Some people do it for longer. I just think I find people really emotionally give on a, you know, when you're writing a song and you're a camp, you're really pulling out of each other. And it can be that you're writing with people you've never met before.
Mm, yeah.
So you're creating and you're emotionally giving. So to do that over more than 4 days, I think you get to the end of yourself. So I would say three or four is the best scenario.
When did this idea of writer's camp come up? I remember seeing something about it here in the States a couple years ago, but I never remember hearing any, you know, the term prior to that. Is this something new, or has this been going on for a while in the UK?
I think we've been doing it for about 4 or 5 years, calling it camp, yeah. The Writers' Camp. I guess that's really that you're the camp idea is you're all in the, because, you know, we don't know in tents. We're all,
yeah, right.
You're all in the same place at the same time doing the same thing. So, and you're kind of living it, I think, instead of going in it. And I think it's a good thing because you go away from your own natural habitat. You're away from your own studio. And actually that often pulls gems out because you're not comfortable. So you're having to be uncomfortable and you're pulling out. And so you're reaching to the bottom. I often think the best songs we've done are often the ones where you're at the bottom of yourself or at the end of yourself. And out pops this little thing, you think, oh, we were struggling with that all day, or it comes at the beginning where it just comes out because the little connections, the sparks between the different writers.
Yeah.
But I think it came from, we were doing, I mean, not that we invented it, but we were doing individual song, you know, so we've got two rooms originally, and we had a session going on in this room and a session going on in that room, the second room, and then we built a third room. And then suddenly we've got the potential for 9 people and they can stay. You know, so instead of doing individual sessions, it was like, well, this feels more like, okay, we can do a 3-day thing and have much more focus and then get 9 songs out of it, and we're all eating together and we're all... So I think that's... certainly for us, it's giving us a lot more focus on, you know... And I think as well, we used to write a song every day and aim it at this, and I think now it's... Most writers and producers probably can't just write a song every day because they need to do production work or TV work, or so they need some, you know, because the income has shrunk. So it means that in 2 weeks' time we can focus on this particular project, and then we have a couple of weeks where you're finishing the songs, and then you've got a paid job, and then 2 weeks' time we have another focus of this particular project, and then you finish the productions. Because that's another thing with the camps. The important thing is that you keep on following up to make sure the producers finish the songs.
Yeah.
Because you can, if it goes too far past, then they're on another camp, or they're doing this, or they're doing that job, and then the further it goes, the, you know, the least likely it is to get done. So I really try and say, look, make sure you finish. Let's do it within a month, or have a deadline. You do the camp close enough to the deadline where they know they're going to get a turnaround and a quick result if they do it properly.
Yeah.
So,
great idea.
It's about momentum for me. If you lose the momentum, it's gone. And I think that's the same with we get interest in a song. If we lose the momentum if people start disagreeing that they don't want to do it, and the label goes somewhere else and goes to the song, and then that song keeps momentum and gets released. I think,
yeah,
this business is about, you mustn't stand still at any point. As soon as you're standing still, you can't kind of catch the wind, in a sense. So,
do you see any trends in the music business and trends in music right now?
Well, obviously the EDM thing seems to have been come big time. It's hard to say because we're so global. It's different in every country. I know that, for instance, the UK has become it's a very hard place to pitch songs, and I think Germany is very similar, and probably and Holland is very similar. It's much more about writing with an artist. You know, so if you're not with the artist, you have to develop them and build them up, and whereas Asia is still about pitching songs. So, but as I said, the trends are different in a different place. So I don't know who's leading who, in a sense. I think the US probably does lead, you know, and then the UK likes to think it leads. I'm not sure it does. think. And that's, in honesty, depends where it comes from. But I don't know. I think the US definitely influences the UK, and then some of the UK will influence outside as well. But it's interesting for me because we did this Eurovision, we're at that Eurovision final this year, 2016, and to have Justin Timberlake suddenly appear. And it was halfway through the week we were there, and so suddenly Timberlake's going to play at the final, and it was you felt the whole thing. And this show is like watched by 200 million people, and so I think Timberlake's team, you know, are very clever and going, okay, well, this is something that which you don't really know much about, but there, a lot of people watch it. I can get on that, and actually, suddenly, my job of selling my record is done in one click.
Yeah.
Because, and it was number one in every country straight after that. Because, you know, I know it's Eurovision, but Australia are watching, you know, and China have been watching because they're looking to do an Asia vision. So, whilst it was great for Eurovision to have Timberlake on because it raised the profile, it made it kind of credible, it was also great for Timberlake to actually be on Eurovision to have a cross sell in a sense.
And yeah, yeah.
One Korean teams we've worked with was listening to that song as well and is starting to hear, they think that there's some influence from Korea coming across. And I think maybe that his team are going to play it, thinking, because what I think as Western writers and producers or consumers, we assume the big acts are massive in Japan, you know, the big acts from America, and Korea, but actually they do sell, but they're not as big as we assume they are, because for instance, Japan, 90% of the market is the local market. So I think there's still room for the Timberlakes and the Lady Gagas and the big artists like that to grow even bigger in Asia. And they'll probably be using, if Korea is coming out and influencing, they'll be starting to think about, let's use some of what they do to put it back.
Yeah.
So I think it's a clever move.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Last question, Greg.
Yeah.
And thank you for being with me today. This is great, and I really enjoyed the chat. Was there a piece of business advice that you received from somebody, music business or just something about music, that you received from someone along the way, or maybe you learned yourself?
One of our writers who I travel with a lot, a guy called Ian Curnow, and when we started working with him, he kind of sent me some songs, and I kind of said, "Ooh, is that the Ian Curnow?" Because I actually bought most of the songs, so it's a privilege to work and travel with him. I think it was kind of 5 or 6 years ago, seven maybe more, when we would get some interest from a song, and we weren't sure, is this artist big enough for the song, or, you know, and this song, or we did like that song, but we wanted to, the artist was big and we wanted to have more control, do they do a single or blah, blah, blah. He's been, you know, sold millions of records from his career in various forms, and he kind of would say, as soon as you have written the song, let it go. And in a sense, and your job is, you know, as a writer, is to write the next song. Really, because wherever that song goes, you can't control it. And it could be that the small band or the small act that wants your song becomes the next big thing. And by you saying, no, I don't want to do this because they're too small, you just blocked that. And again, our first success in Japan was with a band called Toshinki. And at the time when it sold, I think it sold something like 70,000 copies, which is not too bad, but it's not now, it's not too bad. But then it was quite small for Japan. We were excited about that. But if we'd have stopped that, then we'd also have stopped the fact that it was used on a B-side and got another 80,000 copies. And then it went on an album which sold 100. And then if for some reason it went on two other albums, which was 200 and 250,000. So once you add that together, actually, we had a very big success there. And basically, I go back to that a lot. Someone was asking me that question the other day. It was, you know, this act looks a bit small. And I kind of say, well, a wise man once told me,
yeah, yeah,
just go with it because you can't control it. And we've had it the other way around as well, where we've had it for a big artist and it's ended up quite small. But I think the songwriter's job is go and write the next one, because songs have a life outside of the studio. The writer's job is to get the next song, the next hit, and see where it goes.
To find out more about Greg and DWB Music, go to dwbsongs.com, dwbsongs.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or just go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.